From KCUR, I'm Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. From start to finish, you always want to make your holiday meal special. The food is obviously an important element, but the accent of the right drink is an equally important flourish. This hour, wine expert Doug Frost joins us for a primer on how to put the proper spin on the appetizer, brighten the main course, and make that dessert really special, all by adding the right wine to the mix. We'll find out what bottle can make you a nice, crisp starter, when to pop open that rich port you've been saving, and maybe see what pairs well with cheese or fruitcake. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Doug Frost is back. The main thing to know about Doug is that he's just one of four people on the planet who is both a master of wine and a master sommelier. So yes, we'll be talking holiday drink ideas and wine as Doug highlights selections from his list of the top 10 regional wines of 2014. You can find the complete list at kcur.org. And Doug, always good to have you here. It's always a holiday when you're here, and it's always great to have you. Welcome back.
The timing is good.
And we have some official KCUR tasters gathered around our table here in the Walt Bodine studio. Peggy Lowe is part of Harvest Public Media's team here at KCUR. Peggy, welcome to you.
Good morning.
Doug Margulies is KCUR's...
Dan Margulies.
Doug, Dan. Dan Margulies is KCUR's health editor. Dan, nice to have you. Welcome.
I'll soon they forget.
And Lisa Rodriguez is also with KCUR. And Lisa, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Thank you.
So good to have you here. And Doug, you want to begin with something called the official pour. P-O-U-R.
Well, indeed. Ladies first here, but we're having a little bit of bubbly from Les Bourgeois Vineyards. I thought we would go with a, you know, Missouri theme this time around. I think it's a completely appropriate since Danny and I had been talking about that from the outset. And it's a grape called Vidal Blanc, which is a grape that does quite well in this area. It's a grape that's become very important in this
Yeah, we need one more glass here.
Steve, yeah. I believe yeah, we've cut off the host.
Okay. Yeah,
well,
we cut off
that's the host. Nice to the host.
Love that.
Yeah. Here we go. But it's a grape that's done quite well in this area and makes, I think, a very nice sparkling wine. And I was very impressed with this wine. This was one of the award winners at the Missouri Governor's Tasting. And a lot of people always expect that a Missouri wine is going to be sweet. It's not necessarily going to be sweet. I would say that in general, smaller regional wine industries like Missouri's tend to focus on sweeter wines because it appeals to more people, frankly. I mean, the idea somehow that has been promulgated that Missouri wines are always sweet and they're just made for, you know, people who don't know much about wine is really based on the fact that, frankly, most of the people who are willing to drink a glass of wine probably don't know that much about it and would like a slightly sweeter wine. And Missouri, just like, frankly, Texas or Colorado or Virginia or many other areas, and indeed, as California was 100 years ago, they make sweet wines to appeal to a population that's still discovering wine.
Well, and as you're talking, Peggy Lowe has brow furrowed, and she is nodding her head slowly in complete, I think, agreement. You like this wine.
I like this wine. It's not sweet, thank
it's
heavens.
Not sweet.
I can't stand sweet. It has very intense bubbles. I dig the bubble. And
the bubble is good.
Yeah, and I like the name, too, Bourgeois.
Well, it's actually the last name of the family that owns it. So it's the Bourgeois family, which is pretty grand when you decide to go into the wine business, I think.
That's
and you're
very
right.
Cool.
The bubbles are intense. That's a great word for
bubbles.
It. Dan, what'd you think?
I'm with my colleague Peggy here, Steve. I don't ordinarily cotton to sweet wines. There is an element of sweetness here, but it's also offset by a kind of tanginess that is really, you know, it gives you a little zets, to use the Yiddish word.
Yes.
I think it's that offset that really appeals to me so often with a lot of wines, because actually I'm one of those people that does drink sweeter wines, at least on occasion. I like really spicy food, And spicy food, basically, you're just dealing with receptors in the mouth that are receiving capsicum or, you know, that kind of oil that you get out of hot things. And it literally sends a message to the brain that it is temperature hot. So what you do to break that bond, if you will, or at least interfere with that connection, is you put something sweet in there. It'll fill up the heat receptor and make the food less hot. So you get that flush of heat, and then it cools off with a glass of something sweet. You can do the same thing with dairy, though, cheese or milk. Or things like that will also block that receptor. And even cilantro seems to have a purpose in spicy food, that it can help block that receptor. But so I love that notion that it starts out a little sweet and ends a little tangy. And honestly, I'd have to say that classic sparkling wines around the world, especially champagne, tend to be a little bit sweet. There are very few that aren't bottled with some sugar added to them. And in this case, there's really no sugar added. It's just a little bit of unfermented grape juice. So just a touch of sugar remains.
Dan Margulies, you are KCUR's health editor. Did you understand before that explanation what happens when you ingest very spicy food and what happens to your brain and all of that?
Only in the most abstract kind of way. I do understand what happens to my brain. But that's a very good explanation. You know, I'm a vegetarian, as you know, Steve. So I'm wondering, Doug, what foods in particular this would go well with?
Well, I think sparkling wine is the old liquid chicken. It goes with everything. It really is. I mean, I love it with fried food because, you know, when you think about fried food, what do you always try to accomplish with fried food? You try to get the oil as hot as you can so it doesn't take up too much oil and doesn't get oily. So the key to me has always been, well, then I want a wine that makes it seem less fried. And the bubbles, the CO2 that naturally come out of a sparkling wine, helps the fried food seem less fried. Uh-huh. So that's one of my keys. But in general, I will add sparkling wine to virtually any dish out there at all. I suppose maybe not roast beef or short ribs or something like that, but I have it with grilled fish. I have it with, you know, lasagna. I mean, I'm pretty wide open and receptive.
Lisa Rodriguez, the KCUR listening audience awaits your judgment on this sparkling wine. We're two for two so far, two thumbs up. Where are you on this one?
I would add a third thumbs up there. I love drinking bubbles. And so this one, I don't think I even need food with it. I think it has a really nice long finish, which some champagnes will dry up right away. But this one really lingers, and I like that a lot.
Okay.
I'd have to say it may be the best Missouri sparkler I've ever had. And there's a lot of people trying to do it. But I was blown away by this, just partly because I love the guys at Les Bourgeois. I always want them to succeed. But, you know, in a role as a critic, you always have to say, yes, but here's what you actually have. And when I tasted this wine, it was like, okay, I don't have to say anything about but. And it's just like, that's awesome. Way to go. You guys rock.
Give the title of this bottle again if folks are out there buying, shopping, and going into a store right now and want to pick this up.
It's from Les Bourgeois Vineyards, and it's just called LBV. And
LBV.
So the short for, you know, Les Bourgeois.
Where are these vineyards, by the way?
It's just outside of Columbia. So Rocheport is where the winery is.
Sure.
And then the vineyards, you can find some of the vineyards right there. And then they buy a little bit of fruit as well from farther center in the state, closer to Rolla. But it's Vidal Blanc from that site. And that's a really cool place. If anybody's gone to MU, you know the bluffs at night, you know, what it's like, in the evening, I should say, what it's like to see the sunset over the Missouri River at Les Bourgeois.
Well, if our listeners have any questions for Doug Frost, Master of Wine, Master Sommelier, for your holiday gathering, for your holiday meals, 816-235-2888 is our number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Doug, I want to read from one of your recent columns in The Star. You wrote this: "So it is this time of year when I am asked questions to which any answer is a random guess at best and an international intentional lie at worst. What wine is best, I am asked. What wine goes with this dish, they implore. Well, you see, it all depends," is what you wrote. It depends on what?
Mostly on what people like. Mm-hmm. I think that it's been, you know, we've oversold, we as the wine industry have oversold the idea that there's a magical pairing, you know, out there waiting for each and every dish and each and every wine. And the magical pairing, as far as I'm concerned, and it's always been my advice given to restaurants, the magical pairing is between the wine and the person, that somebody's going to go, oh my God, this is what I'm talking about. You know, this is what I wanted to have. And we'll get the food and the wine kind of close to each other. Mm-hmm. So I just think that we work too much on you know, we worry too much about somehow being inappropriate. And I don't think people do that with food. You know, somebody doesn't go, yes, I did short ribs, but this time we're doing Brussels sprouts. I know, you're never supposed to do Brussels sprouts with short ribs. I mean, would anybody ever say anything that loony?
But this notion of the right wine with a certain food is so ingrained in the culture. How do you shake that thing out?
I think we just keep screaming the same message until eventually it catches hold. And I think it has, actually. I think a lot of times, for years now, I've been hearing people echo the message that many of us have tried to send. But it is really funny because – and I'm just as guilty as anybody else that we'll do that. It'll be like, hey, listen, whatever you want to have, it's totally cool. By the way, have you ever had this wine with this dish? Oh, my God, it's the best ever, you know. So it's also true, and that's part of the – it depends. It's also true that if you like virtually any wine or if you like this style of wine and you like this food, there can be these moments where you match the two together and something really magical happens. It seems to elevate both of them.
Oh, Peggy Lowe, how do you feel about this notion, if you were to gather people together, are you comfortable enough just sort of picking a bottle of wine that you like and just sort of letting all care go to the wind here a little bit?
I am comfortable enough, and I would also report that I'm cheap enough. So I have long considered myself a connoisseur of cheap red wines, specifically like cheap South American red wines. But I would also ask you, Doug, so when I serve, for instance, like a white wine with a piece of red meat, and someone looks at me like I'm a dilettante or, you know, just from Nebraska,
here it comes.
What would you then, what's your comeback? What do you say?
Well, it's a funny thing. I mean, there's no question that most people think there's something inherently wrong with that combination. And I'd offer two ideas. One is that it's not completely loony to say, well, you know, white wine with red meat sometimes doesn't work because, in essence, I think what we're trying to accomplish when we put food and wine together is to not have one overwhelm the other, whether it's the food or the wine. And a lot of times we would look at something very powerful, a very powerful dish, and think that a soft little white wine is going to be overwhelmed. It probably would be. Maybe that's okay. Maybe that's what the drinker or the consumer wants. Maybe it isn't. It depends upon what those people's proclivities and preferences are, because that's the first thing. They should like what they drink. If I tell somebody, oh, you really need to have red wine with this dish, and they don't like red wine, what a dumb idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really the dumbest idea ever. The other thing I would say that is not nonsense. I honestly will offer this as historical fact. If you go back a century ago, when people would go into the great restaurants, let's say, of New York City, which was mostly about oysters. Everybody knew champagne and oysters. The great oyster beds of New York City, yes, they were the greatest in the world, were celebrated in every restaurant. And then they might follow that with various egg dishes, and they would continue to drink white wine or sparkling wine with that. And they would often finish with a baron of beef, and they would have a sweet wine with that. It was very, very common in Europe as well. Very common to have sweet, particularly sweet German wines with baron of beef. It's a classic combination because the sugar creates a certain weight and intensity that can stand up to the meat. Now, no one would ever do that today, although I do like to kind of play with that one.
So express yourself with abandon, Peggy Lowe.
That's
express
right.
Express yourself with abandon.
Yeah.
Good.
There
I will
you
do
go.
That.
Let's go to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. Your questions about wine and the good food you're serving this holiday season. Neil from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. How you doing?
Well,
you
thanks, doing, Neil. Happy holidays.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Question for Doug. I know Doug, and this is a curveball he may expect from me, but I'm wondering if he has any suggestions regarding beer for the holidays.
Oh, yeah.
You've been known to serve beer with your turkey, I think.
Oh, absolutely.
You've talked on the show before.
Yeah. I'm one of those people that really does hang out outside the liquor store waiting for the Boulevard Smokestaps series, the new one to show up. I'm that guy.
How do you like that?
I'm nuts about everything that they make. I would have to say my favorite is Rye on Rye. It's a rye beer aged in rye whiskey barrels and has a lovely intensity to it as a result, a caramel sort of note, grainy, malty sort of note. It's not super hoppy. I'm really not one of those people that likes really hoppy beers. I like beers that are a little richer and maltier in style. So I haven't tried to skirt the question, but it always comes back to, gee, it depends. But there are so many – there's such – diversity in beer available in this city and in this region and in the country now. It's never been better. The beer scene is as lively as one could imagine it will ever be. Indeed, a lot of us expect sort of a shakeout in the industry. So there are dessert beers out there that are so much fun at the holiday table. Mm. There are, you know, more muscular beers like the Rye on Rye or I think the Bourbon Barrel Quad and things like that.
A dessert beer. Help me with that. What's a dessert beer? That's new to me.
There are beers that are sweet in style, that are heavy in alcohol. Often the two go together and can be chocolatey. Sometimes chocolate flavors show up. Sometimes fruit flavors show up and are indeed added. And there's so many options now that it's really gotten good, Neil. So, it's like I wander into the store now and my eyes sort of glaze over and I just do the, oh, my God, there's so much to play with here. But I usually end up just buying something I haven't bought before.
And that continues to be an issue that, again, we've talked about this many times. You walk into a liquor store, the number of choices and options is so overwhelming that, you know, consumers who aren't up to speed as you are, it can really be a difficult experience. You don't know what to pick and which bottle to go for. And the industry really hasn't done much when it comes to education and labeling. And again, you're very high on that idea, too.
Well, yeah, I think that the simplest thing in the world would be, and I know I'm this wouldn't be the most popular solution, but the simplest solution would be taste it. That you could just walk up and go, I want to taste that one. Can I taste that one now?
Why can't we do that?
Well, there are
you need licenses and all that stuff.
Yeah,
right?
There are places you can do that. There are certainly stores out there that offer tasting before you buy. But it is always limited, certainly by legal regulations. And needless to say, about the 12th taste, it might be time for somebody to drive you home instead of driving yourself home.
So
you might start to make
there.
Foolish choices, yeah. You know, when it comes to your purchases. But here's the thing. Here's what I always think should happen. You should find a retailer who knows your taste, who knows what you like, so that people don't go, I got it for 50 cents less down this street. Who cares? Maybe it's not good. Maybe it's not what you would like. The key should be that you walk into the store and I have a store. It shall remain nameless, but I walk in and the guy there is like, hey, have you tasted this? I'm like, no.
Yeah.
He's like, well, you need it because he knows what I like. So I'm like, okay, I'll buy that one. That's cool. And so that's the key to me is that you make friends with a retailer who gets what you like, who gets what you don't like, and isn't about to sell you something just because somebody said it got 95 points. You know, who cares? They're going to sell you something because they know you liked something similar to it last time you were in.
Damn,
so
you're
saying your spirits retailer should be like your local librarian.
That's a perfect illustration. That's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. I like that.
Well, you're a former business writer, Dan.
Yes, sir.
This is your business idea to make your millions here. There you go.
I think that ship has sailed, Steve.
I don't think so, Dan. You're selling yourself short. 816-235-2888. We're talking wine and spirits with Doug Frost, Master of Wine, Master Sommelier, or tweet us at KCUR, up to date. Mary Ann from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
I'd like Doug to comment on the significance of using the correct wine glass with the wines you drink. I was just at Le Bourgeois a couple of hours ago and bought Norton wine glasses because we received a bottle of Norton wine.
Well, that's a wonderful question, Marianne. It really is. And I will try not to give the super long answer to it because I am long-winded. I admit it's the wine. It's not me. It's really the wine. But it is that – I think people worry too much about the correct glass, one. Secondarily, I do have, nonetheless, my own requirements for a wine glass, which is I think that the bowl itself should slightly tilt inward so that the top is smaller than the bottom, and it helps focus the aromas so it's easier to smell them. I do not like the funky old school where they give you a juice glass. I can't smell anything in there. Mm. I can't swirl the glass and get aromas and smell it, because that's, to me, half the fun of wine is just sticking your nose in there and really moving your nose around, and you'll get different aromas if you have a nice wine in there. I don't like also the glasses that don't have a stem. I know some people do. I think there's a better word for it. I hate them. I hate those glasses because, you know, my hand starts warming the wine up. And I, as you can tell, I drink a lot of white wine as well as red wine. And I want my wines to be cool when it's a red wine. I want it to be, almost cold when it's a white wine, and the stemless glass prevents it from staying that temperature. But aside from that, I don't worry about it too much. The Norton glass is kind of a funny story. There's a very famous glassmaker named Riedel, run by a gentleman named George Riedel, who's Austrian, and he came into Missouri to design a glass for the Norton grape, the official state grape of Missouri. And I will have to tell you, there was this moment. There's like 45 winemakers in the room, and I'm hanging out there as well. And he's extolling the virtues of the glass we're about to choose, whichever glass this might be. And he says to 45 Missouri winemakers, we are the show me state, right? He says, my glass, it will stir your soul. Which pretty much 45 people all went, nah, I don't think so. Yeah, nah, yeah. It's soul stirring doesn't really happen with a glass here, bro. You know, nice try, though. Nice try.
Yeah. So, yeah. Marianne, I hope that helps a little bit.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Happy holidays to you. And Doug, what's your maybe the big question here? What's your latest thinking on the connection between the price of a bottle of wine and its quality?
I think that there is not a simple equation or not a simple curve to be described between price and quality. What there is a simple curve to be described where there is one is between price and longevity. That mm-hmm. typically when a wine is more expensive, it is partly a message to the buyer that this is a wine that can go in your basement and last for a while. Hmm. If a wine is more expensive, it may not be better. It may just be rare. Most of the time, pricing for wine is based more upon
quantity,
exactly, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. it's an agricultural product. It's very finite. I mean, I don't know what Les Bourgeois on the CLBV, I think they make like, I don't know, something like 8,000 bottles. That's mm-hmm. it. You know, and they can't just like rush out and go make more because it takes a year or two to create this wine. You have to have the right grapes to do it. So you can't just a la Coca-Cola go batch up another million cases. It just doesn't work like that.
So how much is this Les Bourgeois?
You know, I should know the price off the top of my head. I think it's just under $25, I believe. Okay. It might be $22, and it might be a little less than that. But
that's not bad.
No, it's not a crazy price.
Yeah. Again, our number 816-235-2888. And do you have a second bottle you're going to pour here?
Did it not make it all the way around?
We're not sharing with Steve.
Steve is the host. I don't have a glass handy.
Is there something that he's done in the recent past that makes you want to limit his?
Yeah, we're mean.
We want him to be the one sober person at this table.
Well, this is a wine called Traminette, or I should say a grape called Traminette, and it's from a family called the Nobilis. They're Nobilis, I should say, and it's also Missouri wine, and it's a very, very distinct nose, and that's one of the reasons I brought it was just to say, hey, check out the aroma on this thing, and what do you think? Do you not like? And then taste it to see how it tastes a bit different than it smells.
We can hear the sniffing over the ear. I love that. That's the power of live radio. Dan Margulies, what do you think?
It has a lovely floral scent, I must say. And again, I am not particularly partial to sweet wines, but this is really lovely. It really is. I mean, this is a sweet wine that I could go for.
Lisa, what do you think?
I was actually surprised after I smelled it. I got a lot of like minerality on the nose. And so when I tasted it, and it was a little bit, it had a very rich mouthfeel, and it was sweeter. And that was surprising to me. But I love being surprised.
Minerality. I love the words. Words I don't know.
I think this woman is a professional.
Yeah, she could be. Peggy.
The intern is clearly kicking our tails today. Yeah, Lisa's winning.
Happens all the time around here.
Absolutely. So. I found the wine a little too sweet after we'd had the Les Bourgeois. That said, it really does wear on you, and it tastes good, and it doesn't taste too sweet. And I would think it might be something to serve with some food. I kind of wanted something to eat with it.
Yeah, it certainly is one of those wines. There's enough sugar here that it's going to please somebody who's looking for something sweet, but it would be nice with a lighter dessert. It would actually be good with spicy food as well, but the characteristic that I find so much fun is exactly as Dan said. It's so floral. It is what we call a hybrid grape. It's a grape that has been created for this area, for this part of the country, and one of its progenitors is a grape called Gewürztraminer, which always has a sort of floral, or almost always has a floral. Sometimes people talk about lychee nuts, but for me, it smells like white flowers, and it's so intense, and yet You get in the mouth, and I think there's a little bit of delicacy there,
it's
despite
delicious.
The sweetness and the weight, as Lisa talked about. So it's a fun wine. It's not a super serious wine, that's for sure. Mm. It's intended to be more of a summer refresher, but I thought it's fun to talk about this grape. I think this grape has a tremendous future in this part of the country.
And the name of this bottle, again, is?
This is Nobilis Traminet, and it's actually the 2013, so their most recent bottling of Traminet.
In our second half, we're going to be tasting what? Give us a little preview.
Well,
of where we're
it's
going
time
here.
To go to New York State. I thought okay. I didn't want it to be all Missouri all day. I thought we should mess around and talk about regional wines from other places like the Finger Lakes.
Yeah. Well, that sounds great.
Let's
that
go.
Sounds great. Okay, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our tour of the world's wines with Doug Frost, Master of Wine, Master Sommelier. If you have a question, please call 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Today we're talking with a master of wine, Doug Frost, about great picks for your holiday meals and different options that you can think about here. Doug, we're also joined by our official tasters, Peggy Lowe, Dan Margulies, Lisa Rodriguez. Tom wrote us Doug. He called in from the highway, and he's wondering what creates the earthy, almost mushroomy aroma in French and Italian wines. I've never experienced this with an American wine, he says.
That is a fantastic question.
Yeah.
I think to provide the most honest answer, it would be to say if you were to allow California wines to age long enough, you'll pick up that mushroom character as well. Mm. But typically we drink our California wines a little bit younger. Typically, for example, a California Chardonnay, we'd be drinking the 2013s and the 2012s right now. If we were to drink a medium or high quality French Chardonnay, we'd probably be drinking 2010 or 2009. So time does the trick to some degree. Mm. But I'd also have to say he's quite right in that in general, people are willing to utilize older barrels. And this is just one example of where that smell comes from. But one example would be that people tend to use very new barrels if they use barrels in winemaking in the U.S., and they tend to use used barrels in winemaking if they use them in Europe. Now, an old barrel smells like an old barrel. And one of the things it kind of smells like is like mushrooms. It has this mushroom smell. So huh. I would say, you know, part of it is age. Part of it is used barrels. But then there's that third answer that links back to something Lisa said. This notion of minerality is one that is very controversial because it's very difficult to describe how it is that a wine picks up the mineral smell of a particular place. Indeed, scientists right now are adamant. There's a big battle going on in which scientists have declared us in the wine industry as complete BSers. We're just making this stuff up. There's no way there's minerality in a wine because there is no proven pathway for the minerals in the soil to end up in the grapes, which end up in the wine, to which my response is usually, okay, we don't know the pathway for gravity either. Is it a particle? Is it a wave? You're right, so gravity must not exist. I mean, give me a break.
Yeah,
just
right.
Because we don't know the pathway doesn't mean it's not there. And what I usually say is there's a wine from Greece called – from the island of Santorini that's just called Santorini. And buy a bottle of Santorini – take a taste of it and shut up, okay? Because that is like liquid rocks. And when you drink it and you look at the soil, if you're lucky enough to be on the island of Santorini, you go, yeah, that's it. And if you picked up the soil and smelled the soil, you'd go, yeah, that's it. That's what it smells like. It's crazy. I mean, we don't know how. We don't know why. But it can happen in certain wines from certain places.
We'll be talking about Doug's list of his top 10 regional wines of the year. LBV is one of the wines on that list. Back to some calls at 816-235-2888. Mary Jean from Lenexa. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. And thank you for having Doug on the show.
Absolutely.
So approachable.
Yes, he is.
The question I would have for Doug is I believe he is quite a wine ambassador for Kansas City as he travels around the world. And I just wondered, how do people perceive Kansas City when they know of his background?
I love that question, Mary
ambassador?
Jean.
You're on.
Oh, you're a wine ambassador.
No, it's funny. It really is. I honestly, this happens to me all the time. I like to weave in my Kansas City past into my stories as I'm talking about how people perceive wine or receive wine or talk about wine or what have you, I usually try to find a way to insert it in there. And almost every time if I'm giving this lecture outside the city, like, you know, I'll be in New York City, somebody will walk up and go, I really, really liked that story that you told about Kansas City. Where do you live now? And so it's one of those, Kansas City, you know, and they're like, oh, I'm sorry. And it's like, no, it's okay. There's no apology required. It's just one of those. They assume that you live in New York or they live in or you live in California, something like that. And I think, you know, I like it here. And this place has made it possible for me to do what I'm doing. That is the absolute bottom line. And could I have done it elsewhere? Perhaps. But I definitely believe that Kansas City and its culture and its unique restaurant industry and the people here have made it possible for me to do what I get to do, and which is have way too much fun.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mary Jean, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Steve.
You bet. Happy holidays. Let's go to Stacy from Olathe. Stacy, good morning.
Hi. I have a question about a liqueur called Chartreuse.
Yes.
I wondered. Yeah, oh, good, you've heard of it. And just the history of it, I just find it fascinating. But specifically, where can I get it here in town? I've started calling liquor stores, and I'm having trouble tracking it down. If you have any suggestions.
Probably Doug's basement, Stacy, but beyond that, where can she get it?
Yeah,
I'll take my answer off the air.
Oh, no worries, Stacy. Thank you. Chartreuse is a very interesting liqueur. There are several iterations of it that you can get at several different proof levels, and then a long-aged one as well. It can be pretty expensive. It is creation of a group of Cartusian monks, hence the name. And initially, so the story goes, and it appears to be a true story, initially it was created just as a vehicle for quinine and some other healthful medicinal herbs because the monastery was right next to a swamp, and the swamp had mosquitoes, and people were getting malaria, and nobody really knew why, but they knew if they drank this quinine drink or this liqueur that had quinine and other herbs in it, they didn't get sick. And it became very famous as a medicinal herb, and indeed, so they say, and I've never actually been able to find one of these bottles, but so they say the old bottles actually said, drinking this brings one closer to God. And I've had some nights like that too, although I think it was Mezcal. I'm very sure it was Mezcal. So, but it's, finding it around town, I would literally do what you're doing, just get on the phone, and the place that you find that has it is probably the place you want to keep going back to, because they're serious about the diversity of offerings that they have.
Okay, and since our break, you have poured a third glass of wine, a little tasting here for our very good tasters, Peggy Lowe, Dan Margulies, and Lisa Rodriguez. And Dan, as you tip the glass backwards?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I see that it's a Riesling, right?
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, I am not a Riesling fan ordinarily. This is unusual. I've never tasted one like this. Really different. It took me aback at first when I took my first sip, and the more I sip, the less aback I am. It has an interesting apple sort of quality and woodsy quality. I don't know if I'm summoning the right adjectives, but it is different from any Riesling I've ever tasted.
Lisa?
I love this wine. I do, and I drink a lot of white wine, but I really like funky whites, and this to me is a funky white wine. It's not – you know, when you think of Riesling, you think of something sweet, but to me, it's savory, and I like it. I would like to pour myself another taste.
Sweet and savory, Peggy Lowe. Can you top that?
Yeah, I saw the label, and I hate Rieslings. I just think they're sticky, sweet, something, you know, you drank in high school or something gross like that. And so I did the unusual move of pouring myself just a teeny tiny sip, and I usually don't pour like that for myself. But I was,
as I can attest.
I was very surprised, and it was funky. I love that word, Lisa, and it was very good.
Yeah, it's a dry Riesling. I mean, there's a little bit of sweetness to it, but it's really hidden underneath the tartness, the inherent tartness, because the grapes themselves were not what we would call fully ripe. This is Finger Lakes in New York State, and I think they make fantastic Riesling. I think that's the site of the best Riesling in America without any caveats at all. I mean, it's like, period, end of story. Washington does good stuff. Oregon does some. California does some. forget about it. Actually, the only other place I would say that has lovely Riesling is Michigan. But Finger Lakes, man, they've got about 35 wineries there, that each of which I would gladly drink. And they make them dry, slightly sweet, very sweet across the board. And so this thing is just, you know, to me, it's like tart green, underripe peach and yellow apple. And there is a little bit of funk to it. I think the funk will fade. And actually, I think it's a little bit of sulfur. It has been classic for about 5 centuries or so for people to utilize a tiny, tiny, tiny amount of sulfur to help a wine stay fresh longer, whether it's in a barrel or in a bottle. And this is one of those cases where I'm like, huh, it's interesting. The sulfur is showing a little bit. But sulfur exists to bind up with oxygen. And so I would bet the farm in 3 months you'll taste this wine, and that funk will have been reduced. But that savory element's still going to be there a little bit, and it's what I like about this wine too.
You know, in response to our caller about chartreuse, Lori emails to say that it can be found at Gomer's. So there you go.
There you go. Very, but I would definitely check your favorite retailer because you may be surprised. They may have it as well. There's a green, a yellow version, one that's called VEP. Each one is very interesting. They're all worth it. And their fun is not as standalone liqueurs solely, but their fun is little tiny amounts in certain cocktails.
Well, what does it taste like?
It is very minty herbal, okay. You know, kind of maybe more mint than fennel, but all that stuff. And then imagine that there's probably 45 herbs in it or so, maybe 90. No one knows. It's secret formula, locked away, only 3 months. Seriously,
only
3 months. Only 3 months at any time.
What kind of monks were these?
Cartusian monks.
And where are they?
Southwest France.
Not Cartesian. Cartusian.
Cartusian, exactly. Exactly. They were not following Descartes, but rather, I believe the association is with the Church of Chartres. So I think that's – I should know, but I don't.
Randall tweeted us at KCUR up to date to ask Doug, it's a beer question, but did you have a chance to taste Free State's limited release of Oud Max Imperial Stout? Fantastic, Randall writes.
You are the third person who's told me this in the last couple of weeks, and it comes back to the where can I get a bottle of that? Mm-hmm. You know, it's the beer story now. Like I said, where we're lurking outside of liquor stores till the driver shows up.
Dan, you about jumped out of your seat when I mentioned it.
I did because it so happens I had one last night, and it was fantastic.
Hmm. Did you have it at a restaurant or?
I had it in the privacy of my own home.
Okay, so he found a bottle.
Where'd you find it?
My wife found it. You'll have to ask her.
Have to ask her. Okay. 816-235-2888. Doug Frost is our guest, Master of Wine, Master Sommelier. You know, Doug, one purpose of your visit today was to run down a list of the top 10 regional wines. I've mentioned that you've already talked about one at length, LBV. What else do you want to highlight from this list? And what does this list say about the quality of wines coming out of the heartland of the country?
Well, there are a series of grapes here that I think we're starting to figure out. And it's one of the, you know, I sort of get a chip on my shoulder often when people will say, from, let's say, California or Europe in particular. I just came back from Europe. People were saying, oh, yes, you have to use hybrid grapes. And it's like, well, look, you know, we've had 500 years to get Cabernet straight. We've had 800 years to get Chardonnay straight. We've had a lot of people working on it. And Chamberson, not so much. Traminette. We've only had a decade or so to work on Traminette and very few people working on it. So it takes a long, long time and a lot of people and a lot of effort to figure out the best way to grow a grape, the best place to grow a grape, the best way to turn that into a wine. And it, you know, the more people who can work on it, the better. So I get, a little bit defensive saying, well, yeah, we're not making a ton of great Traminettes yet because there's only about 25 people trying as opposed to the thousands and thousands who are trying to make a good Chardonnay. So it comes down to the grapes for me. Traminette is a fascinating grape and is going to make excellent wine, already is doing so in this area. An affiliated grape called Valvin Muscat is a muscat-y sort of wine, which is to say also very floral, citrus, orange, lemon, things like that kinds of flavors. And we've already seen excellent Valvin Muscat. But there's probably, I don't know, there's probably 6 of them, maybe 8 of them in the entire country. So we're just getting to figure that grape out. Chamberson is a grape that we talk about a lot in the state of Missouri as well. We should. Augusta in particular makes this fantastic Chamberson Montel. It's affiliated winery, same winemaker. And it is the wine I love to take somewhere when people are giving me the attitude about hybrid wine, that they can tell the difference, that it doesn't make, you know, a hybrid grape doesn't make a very good wine. I'm always like, yeah, I know what you mean. Here, let's try this wine. This is a really, this is good. And they drink about half a bottle before I go, hybrid, gotcha. You know, it's a lovely kind of raspberry sort of red cherry tinged wine and makes, I think makes a wine that has a great future.
What else do you want to highlight from this list?
Well, we do have this little red thing here.
Yeah, yeah.
Little gem I brought along with me. This is Stonehill's Cross J Vineyard Norton. Norton, as I referenced earlier, is the official state grape of the state of Missouri, which I think is a very cool thing that Missouri did. It dates back to when our governor was actually a Norton grower himself. And
Nixon?
No, this was the prior governor whose last name,
okay.
Bob, blanking out on his last name, but that's embarrassing, but it must be the age. I'm getting of a certain age. Anyway, Norton was the official state grape. The funny part about that is Norton's original name, or at least for some people its original name, was the Virginia seedling because it's a native to Virginia. But
Norton is also a wonderful vineyard down in Argentina.
Yes, there is. There's a Bodegas Norton in Argentina. They do not grow any Norton, although I've always thought, why not? I mean, come on, you know? A Norton Norton? Who would not want a Norton? Norton Norton, here's a who.
Norton squared.
That's right. But they do make increasingly excellent Malbec in Argentina. But this is the name of the grape. It also goes by the name Cynthiana, which I always find very interesting because Norton, you know, Norton to me, I always feel like I should say Norton, like
Ed Norton.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Norton, you know. And then Cynthiana is very, you know, it's very. So somehow we used to say that as you cross Highway 70 to the north, it was Cynthiana, to the south it was Norton, but it really depends. People just call it sort of whatever they want to call it, either name.
And it smells great.
This is Stonehill's Cross J Vineyard. The Cross J Vineyard is a very old Norton vineyard. And Norton is a good classic example, I think, of a grape we're just starting to figure out. We've been working on it probably off and on for a century, but we had that wonderful noble experiment called Prohibition that shut everybody out of their business for a couple of decades. And it's just, I think, in the last 10 years that Norton's starting to hit its stride.
Peggy, what do you think?
It's delicious. At first blush, I guess to say, it kind of tastes cinnamony or something very spicy. It's delicious.
It's a wacky grape.
I love this. There's a smokiness to the wine that is quite unusual, I think.
Part of that is the grape, but most of that's the barrel. Mm. But it actually, even if you don't put this wine in a barrel, it'll pick up a little bit of that smoky character. I have no idea why.
Lisa, what do you think?
I agree. I like it. I think it's got some earthiness, some smokiness to it. Definitely spicy and drier than I would expect it to be.
Oh, yeah. What stops you from starting your own winery?
Well,
you're busy doing other things, I imagine. But
no, actually, it's quite purposeful in that I think if you're going to make wine, because I don't mean to shout, you know, call anybody out, but I have a lot of my compatriots on the Master Sommelier side in particular who are winemakers, and I'm doing the quotation marks around it because they go and visit a winery a few times a year and they sit around at a blending table and do blending trials and blend the wine to their preference, and then they call themselves winemakers. And I just have to say I'm sorry to be insulting, but that's not being a winemaker. That means you're participating in a blending trial, which all of us can do anytime we want to in the industry. To be a winemaker, you need to know your vineyard. You need to know the vines in your vineyard. You need to know how they act each and every year. You need to be a farmer, in other words. And I'm a city boy, you know. And then you need to live in the winery because barrels change. It's one of the craziest things about wine is you'll make the same wine, you'll put it in exactly the same kind of barrel and show up 6 months later and they smell different. It's like, why? I don't know. Yeah. And if you live in the winery and you smell and check the barrels every single day, you'll know that and you'll follow that. And that's how great wine is made. It's made by a man or woman who lives to know this vineyard and lives to know these barrels or whatever vessel you have the wine in. And I'm not willing to give up my city life.
Well, if that's how you feel about it, then I think Peggy Lowe should start her own winery.
I love that idea, though I think I might drink my profits. I don't think I'd be very successful.
That's actually usually the best outcome for most people.
Yeah, that'd be a little bit of a problem.
They have a saying in the business that the best way to create a small fortune in the wine industry is to begin with a large one.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
What else from your list do you want to mention? This top 10 regional wines. Yeah. Here, I got a list right here.
Right on. I was going to say, you know, I mentioned my Augusta Chamberson, which is actually not on my list, but because I had to throw it in here. I really had to. But Montel, the sister winery, makes a Sauvignon Blanc that is a very nice Sauvignon Blanc. Augusta makes a lovely, relatively dry, I mean almost bone dry, but a relatively dry Vidal Blanc. Les Bourgeois makes a Vignol that – and a Vignol grape is one I haven't talked about yet. It is – has been a difficult grape to grow. We're still figuring this grape out as well. It tends to be very uneven in the cluster. So by that, I mean you'll have a grape that's really like a raisin, and you'll have a grape that's green and tart and unpleasant taste in the same cluster. So the best way to approach that as a winemaker was, well, let it ripen a little more, and we'll just make a dessert wine out of it because the raisins are going to be really, really sweet. It's going to be a sweet wine. But the tart berries in there will make the dessert wine kind of crisp in the finish, which is a nice way to make dessert wine. But to make a dry Vignol has eluded the Vignol winemakers, and particularly the Missouri Vignol winemakers, for years until the last few years. And so what they've done is they've figured out those vines. They've figured out how to regulate, how to hit the vines with enough water, how to pull just the right amount of leaves, expose just the right amount of sunshine, and get those clusters more even. Now you can make a dry Vignol, and Les Bourgeois' dry Vignol, Hermann Hoff's dry Vignol. I'm nuts about these wines. This is another grape and another wine that I want to take to my friends in California or in Europe and say, blind taste them on it and say, what do you think? And they'll tell me that we've discovered a new grape that makes excellent wine, and will be blown away when they find out it's a hybrid.
We're talking great wines for your holiday tables coming up here. 816-235-2888 is our number in the few minutes we have remaining here. What are you going to serve in terms of spirits, wine at your holiday table, Doug? Have you thought about it yet? Do you know?
I'm always working on that one. Yeah. That's like a constant task for me of moving this bottle in and that bottle out. I'm going to pull
– You pick like
– Oh, yeah.
I always have to laugh at our music critics who come in here and they have their top 10 lists of the year. And invariably, until right at the very end, they're swapping in one song for another. They're so committed to the idea of making sure this list is what they want it to be.
It's really true. We are such geeks, you know. Yeah. For me, I'm going to bring up some old Spanish Rioja. I like Spanish wines. I've got some older Riojas in the basement, and I keep trying to remind myself that I'm too stingy. I need to pull the stuff out of the basement. You know, my friends come over, and I'm always saving it for somebody special who's going to come over, who's really going to dig this. It's like, oh, shut up, man. Let it go.
Yeah,
Share it with whoever's there. So I'm going to pull out some old Spanish wines. I maybe pull a Vignol. Jowler Creek, which is up the road from us here in Kansas City, they make a really nice Vignol. So maybe I'll have to pull that one out just to mess with people's minds. I always serve champagne. New Year's Eve is nothing but champagne and tamales. Tamales from I will not name which secret place I go down in the district and get my tamales from. But tamales, and then I'll make my own salsas.
Why tamales?
Because they're good.
And I've always heard of tamales, though, on Christmas Eve.
Yes, it's true.
In Colorado, where I used to live, that's what we always
really?
Yeah. Yeah, Christmas Day, Christmas Eve, New Year's Day. I probably 20 years ago decided that I got them for New Year's Day, and then we ate them early because I already had them on New Year's Eve. And we had them with champagne, and the light went off. I think it's actually a really nice combination.
Wow.
Like I said, champagne goes with anything. So we have a lot of cool champagne, and we have some really good tamales, and I make my own salsa verde and stuff like that, and we rock.
Dan, have you thought ahead to what you're doing here? Any special meals coming up that you have?
Well, we're just finishing the end of Hanukkah.
Yes.
So we've been serving a lot of manischewitz. but no, I have not thought ahead to the new year. Champagne is probably the order of the day, like Doug says. And, I'm not particularly picky when it comes to champagne, frankly, because I don't know enough about it. And also because in my case, it doesn't tend to make much of a difference.
Yeah.
After a glass or so, boom.
Yeah. Any thoughts on champagne, Doug?
I think that there are many excellent sparkling wines from around the world. Anywhere you make wine, you can make sparkling wine. All you're really doing is not letting the bubbles dissipate as normally would in a fermentation process, and then creating a secondary fermentation, usually for the highest end stuff, in the bottle that you're buying. So you end up with a little more bubbles. We've tasted a Missouri Sparkler. One of the most certainly one of the most popular wines in the U.S. market right now is Moscato d'Asti, or Sparkling Moscato from California, or even Argentina and Chile. We've seen it from Australia as well. That is not with the not made by a fermentation in the bottle, but in a big, big tank. It's not very expensive. It's usually a little bit sweet. And it's delicious. Just because it's sweet doesn't make it wrong, you know. and the higher end sparklers, California has some fantastic beverages like Domaine Carnot Rev, Roederer Estate, which is in Mendocino, makes one called L'Hermitage. They are more expensive than a lot of champagne, and I would argue worth it. But I also have to admit that when it comes right down to it, I think champagne is a special place. Lots solid chalk. It's the chunk of what's called the edge of the bowl that is the Paris Basin, and it's solid chalk. Mm-hmm. And it does something to the wine that's different, and it makes very long-lived wine. So I typically buy champagne, and then I try to age it for 2 or 3 or 10 or 15 years. Not everybody should do that. Mm-hmm. It's just me, but I think that's pretty cool, and that's what I love pulling out on Christmas. One of those old guys.
You have a port on your list there. Is it just me, or have ports had something of a resurgence of light?
I think you're right. I think that people are paying a little more attention to port. This is Adam Pukta, another Missouri producer, and Tim Pukta, the current head of the family. This is an estate that's been around for 150 years, and they make cool wines, and the port just gets better and better and better, and it's made 100% from Norton. It's a Norton port,
wow.
Which, you know, with that earthy, that the character that it has, it does, earthy, smoky character, does really well as a port. I'm not sure if people are drinking that much more port because the world's sort of afraid of having a higher alcohol fortified wine at the end of dinner when they're out. And I think it's a great shame. I think people should hold themselves back for just a little sip of port or sherry or Madeira or something like that, one of the world's great fortified wines at the end of a meal. It really changes the way the meal ends. It makes it much more contemplative, and that's just me, I suppose.
You're talking about the end of a meal, and we're at the end of our show, if you can believe that or not.
Yeah. Rats.
Okay, rats, yeah. I want to thank Doug Frost, Master of Wine, Master Sommelier. Doug, it's always a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
Always enjoy
for
having
me
here. And our official tasters, Peggy Lowe, Dan Margulies, Lisa Rodriguez. Happy holidays to everybody. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks,
always
Steve.
Good to have
you. Thank you.